Happy International Women's Day. My name is Priya Reddy. Today we're going to learn the ways in which the United States forces its Christian fundamentalist policies on women around the world by bullying the United Nations and international aid agencies and the deadly consequences thereof. If you ran into such irrational fundamentalists, you might just tell them to take their antipsychotic medication and stop causing trouble. However, because these rabid anti-choice, anti-women ideologues have so much influence over the United States and power over the rest of the world, we are forced to confront their insanity. Today, we're going to talk to some very smart women about that problem.
My name is Andrea Lynch, and I'm from the International Women's Health Coalition. IWHC, the International Women's Health Coalition, works to promote and protect the sexual and reproductive health and rights of women and young people worldwide. And we do this by supporting organizations led by women and youth that are advocating for women and young people's health needs and human rights. And we also try to advocate for policies at the international level that are going to be supportive of reproductive health and human rights.
Can you explain to us Bush's global gag rule and how that destroys the lives of women?
The gag rule, which is also known as the Mexico City policy, is a policy that was put in place by Ronald Reagan in 1984. It was lifted by Bill Clinton, and then it was reinstated by President Bush on the first full day of his presidency in 2001. Essentially, what the gag rule does is that it says that any organization overseas that is receiving U.S. foreign assistance for family planning is not allowed to perform abortions, even if they're legal in that country, is not allowed to refer women to places where they can receive safe abortions, even if they're legal in that country, is not allowed to engage in any public debate around the abortion question that might lead to a liberalization or a reform of restrictive abortion laws. For example, they can't publicize public health statistics on the impact of unsafe abortion. And this is an incredibly damaging policy for a number of reasons. First of all, it really is a restriction on free speech for a lot of groups that are essentially being forced to choose between giving up a major source of their funding, in some cases a critical source of their funding, and being able to provide women and their communities with full reproductive health information and with life-saving reproductive health information. And for the United States to be promoting such a policy and at the same time casting itself as a promoter of democracy overseas is hypocritical. An additional thing that the gag rule does is it generally tends to not be effective in its stated purpose of reducing the incidence of abortion, since it does absolutely nothing to reduce the incidence of unintended pregnancy, which is really the most effective strategy for reducing the incidence of abortion. What it in fact winds up doing is the opposite, because it forces organizations that are providing a whole wide range of reproductive health services, such as access to information about contraception, forces these organizations, many of which are also dealing with public health consequences of unsafe abortion, to either give up their U.S. funding or stop providing the full range of services they have to offer.
So the gag rule has been applied mostly to NGOs overseas and foreign NGOs, because you couldn't apply to American groups because it violates the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
That's correct. It would not be constitutional to apply it in this country. So essentially what we're doing is we are forcing a restriction on foreign organizations that would not be applicable in the United States, and this restriction runs counter to the laws of many of these countries.
And so some of the poorest, most vulnerable women in the world who turn to these clinics for help can't even get the complete health care options that they're entitled to or need.
Despite the fact that abortion is heavily restricted, it's also widely practiced, and women with money in other countries can go to a doctor, whereas poor women, women living in rural areas, younger women, indigenous women who are more sort of outside the mainstream of their country's health systems and services are the ones who are disproportionately suffering from having to resort to unskilled, illegal, clandestine providers. And this is why we see that about 68,000 women at least are dying from complications of unsafe abortion every year, and that a full 13% of all deaths in the world related to pregnancy and childbirth are due to unsafe abortion. That is disproportionately poor women, women that these non-governmental organizations in other countries are trying desperately to reach, but the United States is compromising their ability to do so with policies like the global gag rule. What's important to note as well is, while abortion is heavily restricted in most countries in the world, in about 120 countries worldwide, it's actually legal under certain conditions. For example, if a woman's life is in danger, or if the pregnancy is a result of rape or incest. And yet these organizations can't even interpret the laws of their countries to the women who are coming and trying to get information about them.
So women dying from unsafe abortion has been described as a humanitarian crisis of enormous proportions by women's health groups like yourself. But that you're not even allowed to talk about that under the global gag rule.
That's correct. You're not allowed to advocate for a reform of abortion laws or wider access to safe abortion services under the global gag rule.
And they just can't afford to lose the funding, as they have to treat AIDS victims as well as, you know, rape victims and all kinds of people desperate for health care services.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the organizations that we've worked with for a number of years in Peru is an organization that's been around since the 1970s and is working on a very wide range of issues affecting women's health: violence against women, wider access to health services in general, even working on monitoring policies on women's political participation, things that really go way beyond the question of abortion. But, of course, abortion is a significant part of their agenda as well, since they recognize that it's a major source of illness and injury and death to women in Peru. And over 40% of Peru's population is indigenous, and many of these communities are living in isolated rural areas with barely any access to any kind of health services. These women are also disproportionately suffering from a lack of access to contraception, high rates of violence, lack of access to any kind of comprehensive sexuality education, and so they are winding up with a lot of unintended and unsafe pregnancies. Now, this organization had historically worked with these communities and was awarded several years ago a huge grant from the United States Agency for International Development to work, to pilot a fantastic project with indigenous women that was all about the whole range of indigenous women's health needs and human rights. But they had to sign the gag rule to get this money, and this puts this organization in an incredibly difficult position. And it's really an unfair choice that our government is inflicting on organizations whose purpose is really to help the women in their countries, recognizing that sexual and reproductive rights are a fundamental part of human rights, and that women can't participate economically and socially and politically to the fullest extent in their countries if they can't have control over who they have sex with, when they have sex, and when they have children.
And so sex education, or denying people information about how their bodies actually works, full biological-based sex education, is also under attack.
We have seen a new frontier in the Bush administration's widespread attempts to undermine access to information and services around sexuality and reproduction in the promotion of abstinence-only or abstinence-until-marriage policies. Those are currently being funded within the United States at about $272 million a year. These programs exclude full public health information from young people about how they can protect themselves against STDs, themselves against HIV/AIDS, even how to use condoms.
This information is being denied to people who need it most?
Yes, absolutely. The President's Emergency Plan for HIV/AIDS Relief, otherwise known as PEPFAR, that's President Bush's five-year, $15 billion HIV/AIDS prevention, care, and treatment initiative that's targeting 15 countries in the world, 13 of which are in sub-Saharan Africa, which is really the epicenter of the global AIDS pandemic. And we're seeing that there's restrictions on those prevention funds that are forcing at least one-third of all the money that's going to HIV/AIDS prevention in Africa to be spent on abstinence until marriage programs. That means that the people who are receiving those grants cannot speak about condoms. They cannot speak about giving adolescents and even anyone the full range of prevention strategies in countries where there are very high HIV prevalence rates. We're talking about telling organizations who know that this information can save young people's lives that they cannot share this information with young people. Right now in sub-Saharan Africa, 58% of adults living with HIV/AIDS are women. And now for young women, the statistic is even more shocking. Among 15 to 24-year-olds living with AIDS, over three-quarters, 76%, are girls. And now from these girls, we are withholding full information about how they can protect themselves. And by promoting the strategy of abstinence, we're really not responding to the real conditions that these girls are living under. These girls often don't have any control over when they get married, who they get married to. Many of them are married as teenagers. Many of them are married to men who have had previous wives or who have had many sexual partners beforehand who are 10 or 20 years older than they are. And abstinence is not an option for these girls. And many of their husbands have already been infected with HIV.
And can you talk about the attack on the United Nations Population Fund and actually what that fund was meant to accomplish and how the U.S. has managed to severely undermine the goals of that fund?
Sure. The United Nations Population Fund, or otherwise known as UNFPA, is the agency within the United Nations that's responsible for family planning and reproductive health services, and it's working in about 140 countries worldwide. And it's really the number one provider of these services to women in the developing world. These services include everything from sexuality education for adolescents. UNFPA is working with couples, promoting access to contraception. UNFPA is providing emergency obstetric care in places in sub-Saharan Africa, where 1 in 16 women over their lives have a risk of dying as a result of pregnancy or childbirth. So this is really a vital organization doing vital work. And starting in 2002, the United States has traditionally made a $34 million annual contribution to UNFPA. We withheld that contribution, and we have withheld it every year since. And the reason we withheld it was because there was a very small, fringe, anti-contraception, anti-abortion organization within the United States that accused UNFPA, without evidence, of participating in China's coercive population policies, the one-child policy. Now, four separate investigative teams have been sent to China to investigate these charges, one of them sent by the U.S. State Department. Every single one of them came back and said that the charges were groundless, that UNFPA was working with the Chinese government, but it was working to mitigate the negative human rights violations involved in those coercive population policies. UNFPA is, in fact, a force of putting reproductive health in the context of women's human rights.
And offering vital services to some of the most vulnerable populations in the world.
Absolutely.
We're trying to, but now it's much harder with the U.S. attacking its funding.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, it's ironic that the administration seems invested in reducing the incidence of abortion because, in fact, what Bush has done throughout his pregnancy is
presidency. If he could get pregnant, maybe he'd understand.
Presidency. is consistently cut funding for the very programs that would reduce the incidence of abortion because they would reduce the incidence of unwanted pregnancy. Just in February, he released his fiscal year 2006 budget request, and that includes a $77 million cut to international family planning programs and reproductive health funded by the United States. And we can also see the same patterns taking place within this country as he recently signed into law $5 billion in cuts over 5 years to Medicaid. It's really a similar strategy that's being used, and it's targeting people who are having the hardest time accessing these services are the ones who are affected the most by these policies.
Since it seems like many of these policies are kind of irrational and fly in the face of expert testimony and advice, one has to wonder, where are these Bush administration policies really coming from? Can you give listeners an idea of where this illogical, ideological drive is coming from?
It's coming from a number of different places, and I can't read President Bush's mind, so I don't know exactly what's going on. But I think there are small, fringe, very vocal anti-family planning, anti-contraception, anti-abortion groups in this country that are putting a lot of pressure on the Bush administration to promote these policies. And unfortunately, these groups make up our president's domestic voting base. So what we can see consistently is a lot of these policies are being promoted overseas that fly in the face of best public health practices for more domestic political reasons. I think another thing that's happening is that there are a number of congresspeople and lawmakers in this country who are passing or promoting a lot of legislation that's damaging. A lot of that pressure to promote these policies is coming from folks in the Congress as well who are representing a pretty extreme viewpoint.
And why do you think the Bush administration has catered to sort of a right-wing Christian fundamentalist constituency and sort of allowing them so much influence in shaping what policies that affect people around the world?
I mean, I think a lot of these organizations, they're not credentialed, but they are ideologically in line with the kind of support base that President Bush is attempting to cultivate in this country. There's a willingness to sacrifice science, to sacrifice best public health practices, to sacrifice all kinds of evidence-based information in favor of an ideological agenda. So I think this is just another example of that trend. The U.S. arguments against abortion really do not have a whole lot to do with either a woman's moral authority to make that decision, despite the fact that it's a complex decision, it's a significant decision, it's a decision that varies from woman to woman. There's a very moral approach to the abortion question, but there isn't a practical approach where we see that abortion has existed throughout history. It exists in countries worldwide, and restricting it doesn't make it any less common. It just makes it more unsafe, and it just makes women pay the price for it with either their lives or their health or their ability to bear children for the remainder of their lives.
It's a good, important to understand just how extreme some of the thinking of the U.S. delegations are. I don't think people know.
I've certainly heard certain, for example, members of U.S. delegations to international conferences argue that there's no such thing as a safe abortion because the fetus is always killed in the abortion.
What do the other people at the U.N. do, bang their head on a wall?
There is not an appreciation for consensus. There is a willingness to pursue a very narrow agenda.
Well, I guess making progress on issues, especially where women are concerned, does not seem to be a priority, whereas sort of coercing the international community to adopt the U.S. point of view does seem to be the priority.
We as Americans, I think, have a real responsibility to make our government accountable to these policies and to recognize the real effects that they're having on women and young people overseas.
And finally, it just seems like the whole thing is like a horrendous attack on women, on women's freedoms, and it's a powerful attack, but at the same time, there's also a very spirited resistance.
Absolutely. We work with a number of organizations all over the developing world that are making fantastic progress in their communities and in their countries, and that are getting a lot of support from their communities to promote these issues. A group of women from all around the world just came together to urge the world's governments to mount a much more effective response to the global HIV/AIDS pandemic, so that it really recognizes, so that that response recognizes the fact that women are disproportionately affected by HIV/AIDS, and that women's vulnerability is very different from men's, precisely because they don't have the same degree of control over their sexual and reproductive rights. These women came together, and they've now released, with women worldwide, a compact to end HIV/AIDS. That is available at withwomenworldwide.org. So there's a ton of progress happening on these issues. We know what needs to happen in order to address these problems. And if we can only build that international consensus without intervention from...
without the United States sabotaging these international efforts.
That's a major part of it, yes.
Yeah. Well, it's a tough work. I'm glad that people like you are out there doing it. And do you just want to give out the website of your group as well?
Sure. It's the International Women's Health Coalition at www.iwhc.org.
Thank you so much, Andrea, and we will have your back. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Now, Priscilla Alexander will comment on Bush's anti-prostitution clause.
This is Priscilla Alexander. I worked with Coyote, a sex workers' rights organization, for 20-odd years, and I also spent 4 years working with the World Health Organization on the global program on AIDS as the focal person on sex work.
The anti-prostitution clause that the Bush administration has introduced is similar to the global gag rule because it sort of forces international health clinics dependent on U.S. funds to not... Well, they can't do outreach in the way that they might be able to actually help these women who are exposed to HIV/AIDS, for example.
Right. The best way to help sex workers protect themselves from AIDS is to do proactive kinds of education and make condoms available, teach them language skills when they work with tourists, other things that will give them more control over their situation. But this kind of gag rule makes it so that the only thing you're allowed to do is try to get them out of prostitution, which is not a reasonable alternative in many cases, and it's not necessarily something that the sex workers want. It's really designed to exploit this already marginal group of people. I mean, hardly anybody's going to argue with him about it because there's so much idea that prostitution is terrible and prostitutes are victims. And what they're mainly victims of is the state.
The anti-prostitution clause, it prevents sex workers from receiving potentially life-saving information.
Right.
And many clinics are afraid that things that they do, like, say, give shoes in Bangladesh so prostitutes can go visit a health clinic, that might be seen as encouraging prostitution. So a lot of clinics are dropping various programs that sort of recognize sex workers as human beings.
It isn't whether you like prostitution or you think people should be prostitutes. It's that some people have made the decision to work as prostitutes, and what you're doing is saying they can't have the protections that other workers have, and they need those protections.
Especially when we're talking about the spread of AIDS, not among just among prostitutes, but also among the general population.
Well, they're more at risk than the general population. Women are much more vulnerable because they're more at risk of AIDS from having sex with men than men are from having sex with women.
Brazil actually rejected $40 million in U.S. aid because they didn't want to submit to the prostitution
right.
clause. But most people dependent on U.S. aid don't have that option. So this is a really...
it's a terrible thing. It's like the anti-abortion gag rule. You need to have these resources for people who are in trouble of some kind or another. And if you don't have them, you're just consigning them to death. And that's essentially what they're doing. They're saying that these people, so long as they make the decision to do sex work, are not entitled to be treated as human beings.
Now, the global gag rule on abortion and this newer anti-prostitution clause are the work of a New Jersey Republican representative, Christopher Smith, and they both affect what a clinic provider can say and think, really. And they want to now extend this to U.S. groups, not just groups overseas.
They don't want women to have any control over their lives. They want women to be barefoot and pregnant. I mean, they don't recognize that women have to earn a living. And this is a way to earn a living. And for some people, it's a better option than other jobs. And they make the decision that they're willing to put up with the negative aspects of it in order to gain the positive. Now, what this does is say that women don't have the ability or the right to make those decisions.
The Bush administration, Congress, the U.S. Congress, apparently believe that prostitution should never be condoned or legalized because it creates a market for trafficking in women. And
it's not the legality that creates the market. It's the illegality. Where prostitution is legal and immigrants are entitled to get working papers and work as prostitutes, then they are much safer than if they come into a country and they have to be underground. It is much better for them to be above ground. It's much safer. That's not what the Bush administration is interested in. They're not interested in protecting the workers at all. And it's just easy for them to do this about prostitution because the whore stigma is a very powerful tool against women's freedom.
This anti-prostitution clause is being called the anti-prostitution loyalty oath by activist groups and AIDS-related health providers. So that's it. The whore stigma is kind of being used to force people to, you know, it's hard to argue against the anti-prostitution clause because of that stigma.
The whore stigma is a powerful instrument to keep women under control. I mean, the society is very schizophrenic about this because on the one hand, they like pornography and they like people to be, they use women's sexuality to sell everything. And on the other hand, they don't want women on their own behalf to use sexuality because then that becomes threatening. It's only if it's
under control.
And women also collude in this because they don't want to be called whore. I mean, the whore stigma is phenomenal.
It seems like there's a real attempt here to dehumanize an already stigmatized population.
It's taking a population that's already stigmatized. I mean, the movement among sex workers worldwide is to throw off the stigma, to get recognition, to be treated as workers. That's what sex workers are trying to do all over the world. And it's a powerful movement in Asia. It's a powerful movement in Africa. It's an amazing kind of coming together of women all across the spectrum who work as prostitutes. And this is designed to stop that. This is designed to say, no, women, you don't have that control. You don't have that right.
Thank you so much for joining us for International Working Women's Day.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Priya Reddy, and you can reach me on my website, warcrycinema.org.